with distorted second-hand scriptures. Only in the Quran had the awful purity of the divine revelation been properly preserved. Every last word of it, every last syllable, every last letter came directly from God and from God alone. Perhaps it was only to be expected, then, despite the profoundly ambiguous testimony of the holy text itself, that a tradition should gradually have grown up, which in due course hardened into orthodoxy, that Muhammad himself had been illiterate. Even had the prophet wished to curl up with an infidel book or two, in other words, it would have been beyond him to decipher them. Yet reassuring a reflection, though this certainly provided to the faithful, it still did not rank, perhaps, as the surest evidence that the Quran had truly descended from the celestial heights. Even more infallible a proof was witnessed by the circumstances of Muhammad's upbringing. Mecca, after all, had been inhabited by pagans, not Jews or Christians, and it stood right in the middle of an enormous and empty desert. The ancient capitals of the Near East, which for more than 4,000 years had served as the cockpits of civilization, immense petri dishes teeming with peoples of every conceivable faith, dense with temples and synagogues and churches, were a colossal distance away. Even to the borders of Palestine, where Abraham had built his tomb, and Solomon reigned, and Jesus been crucified, it was a full 800 miles. What likelihood, then, the Muslim faithful demanded to know, that a prophet born and raised so far from such a milieu could conceivably have been influenced by its traditions and doctrines and writings? The sheer prophylactic immensity of the desert that surrounded Mecca, impenetrable to outsiders as it was, appeared to render the answer obvious. Just as it was the blood and muscle of Mary's virgin womb that had, in the opinion of Christians, nurtured the coming into the world of the divine, so likewise, in the opinion of Muslims, was it the spreading sands of Arabia which had served to preserve the word of God over the course of its protracted delivery in a fit condition of untainted purity. But the emptiness into which Islam had been born was more than physical. The void had been a spiritual one as well. Muslim scholars termed it Jahiliya, the age of ignorance. The Arabs, who had drunk and stolen and brawled, and thought nothing of burying unwanted children in the sands, nor of practicing the most unspeakable sexual abominations, nor of conducting the most interminable feuds, had been lost, it appeared to their heirs, in that pitchiest blackness which was the lack of knowledge of God. And this it was that had made the coming of the prophet all the brighter, all the more dazzling and refulgent a dawn. The contrast between Islam and the age that had preceded it was as clear as that between midday and the dead of night. Yet it was not only Arabia that had been lost in darkness. The whole world had laboured in the shadows of Jahl, ignorance. God, however, was great. The old order had been gloriously toppled, and a caliphate established in its place. Everything had been brought to change. The white radiance of Islam, blazing beyond the borders of Arabia to the limits of the globe, had served to bring all humanity into a wholly new age of light. This, however, was to redraft history in a quite stunningly radical way. Never before had the past been dismissed with such utter and imperious disdain. Even to Christians, the cycles of time redeemed by the birth of Christ had served as a preparation for the coming of the Messiah. To Muslims, however, everything that had preceded the revelations of their prophet, all its manifold splendours and achievements, had been the merest phantom show, a shirk-haunted wasteland, to which Islam owed precisely nothing. The effect of this presumption was to prove incalculable. To this day, even in the West, it continues to inform the way in which the history of the Middle East is interpreted and understood. Whether in books, museums, or university departments, the ancient world is invariably presumed to have ended with the coming of Muhammad. It's as though everything that had made antiquity what it was came to a sudden and crunching halt around AD 600. The inherent implausibility of this is rarely considered. Instead, At a time when most historians are profoundly suspicious of any notion that great civilizations might emerge from nowhere, owing nothing to what went before, and transforming human behavior in the merest blinking of an eye, Islam continues to be portrayed as somehow exceptional, lightning from a clear blue sky. Clearly, if the Quran did descend from heaven, then there is no problem in explaining why the stories it tells of Mary, say, should contain such palpable trace elements of Christian folklore and classical myth. All things, after all, are possible to God. Yet even on the presumption that what Islam teaches is correct, and that the midwife of the faith was genuinely an angel, it is still pushing things to imagine that the theatre of its conquests might suddenly have been conjured over the span of a single generation into a set from the Arabian Nights. Just because histories written by pious Muslims 200 years later can serve to give us such an impression does not mean that they are right. The Near East of the Caliphate, at the peak of its power and glory, was decidedly not that of its foundation 2 centuries before. To presume otherwise is not merely to perpetuate the notion of the Arab conquests as the sudden dropping of a guillotine onto the neck of everything that preceded them, but to risk enshrining bogus tradition as historical fact. To understand the origins of Islam and why it evolved in the way that it did, we must look far beyond the age of Ibn Hisham. We must explore the empires and religions of late antiquity. And, if we do, then the landscape through which the first Arab conquerors rode does not seem so very different from landscapes elsewhere in the one-time Roman Empire. Landscapes marked by the seismic shock of superpower collapse, by the desperate struggle of erstwhile provincials to fashion new lives and new security for themselves, and by the depredations of foreign invaders speaking strange languages and adhering to peculiar creeds. What the Arab conquest of formerly Roman provinces such as Palestine and Syria served to demonstrate was that the rising tide beneath which the western half of the empire had vanished was now rolling in across its eastern possessions. "I took from you, at Heracleopolis, 65 sheep. I repeat, 65 and no more. And, as an acknowledgement of this fact, we have made the present confirmation." This was the receipt issued by an Arab warband in 642 to the city fathers of Heracleopolis, a somnolent backwater in what only 2 years previously had still ranked as the Roman province of Egypt. The seamless fusion of extortion and bureaucracy contained in the document would have been nothing unfamiliar to the elites of other abandoned provinces, whether in North Africa or Spain, Italy or Gaul. The security of Rome's empire had gone, and gone for good. Compromise with barbarian overlords in an age of Roman retreat and diminishment had become the name of the game. Granted, the Arabs who had come swaggering into Heracleopolis do seem to have been uniquely self-possessed. Fastidiously, they logged the date of their transaction with the city elders, in Greek, as the 13th of the month of Farmuti of the first indiction, and in their own language as the year 22. To us, with the benefit of hindsight, it is the latter detail that leaps out. Redeemed from a provincial rubbish tip, it constitutes something truly momentous. The earliest mention on any surviving datable document of what would end up enshrined as the Muslim calendar. Clearly, then, it was something more than merely a greed for mutton that had brought the Arabs to Heracleopolis. But what? Some sense of a new beginning? Of a new order, self-evidently? Yet whether their beliefs and ambitions were equivalent to what we would recognize today as Islam is altogether less clear. It's noteworthy, for instance, that the conquerors are described on the back of the receipt not as Muslims, but as something altogether more enigmatic. Majaratii. What precisely this might have meant, and how it was to be linked to the unfamiliar dating system employed by the newcomers, and whether, if at all, it had been inspired by some novel understanding of God, the document does not reveal. Instead, It is the motives of those who are being screwed for livestock, the city fathers of Heracleopolis, that are the more readily transparent. How else, after all, save by attempting to patch together an accommodation with their unwanted guests, were they to salvage anything of the status quo? If there was much from the past that would necessarily have to be junked, then so too was there much that might be redeemed. In what had once, 2 centuries before, been the western half of the empire, the ghosts of Rome's vanished order still haunted the barbarian kingdoms that had been founded upon its grave. In the east as well, judging from the receipt issued at Heracleopolis, the old order did not change overnight, yielding place to new. Its legacy endured. Of course, it was not only Roman ghosts who haunted the dominion established by the Arabs in the 7th century. In the lowlands of Mesopotamia and the uplands of Iran, there was the spectre of the empire of the Persian kings. This dominion had in turn been raised upon the foundations of still older monarchies, sediment upon sun-baked sediment. For imperialism in the East reached back to the dawn of time. Dimly, in the scriptures of the Jews and the Christians, this was remembered, that there had once been such things as pharaohs and great towers raised up on the banks of the Euphrates to the sky. Yet their sense of this rarely served to oppress them, for if the landscapes of Egypt and Mesopotamia could not help but bear witness to their disorientatingly ancient pasts, then so also in the East had it become the practice of its peoples to look fixedly to the future. The Jews awaited their Messiah. The Christians, the return of Christ. Others, too, shared in what had become the common presumption of the age, that the patterns of human affairs were being traced directly by the finger of God. There were the followers of the Persian prophet, Zoroaster, who saw the world as divided into warring factions of good and evil, and the Samaritans, who proclaimed in their creed how there was no God but God, and the Gnostics, who believed that it was possible for a revelation of the divine to descend via angels to chosen mortals, and all the other numerous heretics and cultists and sectarians that the Near East had long seemed effortlessly to breed. Prodigious the numbers of empires sprung from its soil might well have been, and yet not half so prodigious as the number of gods. And this was the soil, the very soil, from which were destined to sprout the pillars of the caliphate, a dominion that proclaimed itself to be both a universal state and the instrument of heaven's purpose. Given all this, how can it possibly make sense to explain the emergence of Islam with reference to Islam alone? That Muslim tradition attributes the origins of the Quran and the Sunnah to an illiterate man living in a pagan city in the middle of a desert is a problem, not a solution. Perhaps, had the revelations of the prophet materialized in some other period and place, then the fact that the presumptions of the late antique Near East are shot through them like letters through a stick of rock would indeed appear an authentic miracle. As it is, the distance between Mecca and the lands of the Roman and Persian empires to the north suggests a mystery of the kind that perplexed early cartographers when they mapped Africa and South America, and observed that the eastern and western coasts of the Atlantic Ocean seem to match like the pieces of a gigantic jigsaw puzzle. Any notion that continents might have been drifting around the globe appeared too ludicrous to contemplate. Only in the 1960s, with the theory of plate tectonics, did a convincing solution finally emerge. A remarkable coincidence turned out not to have been a coincidence at all. The close fit between the religion that came to be known as Islam and the teeming melting pot of the late antique Near East would seem to suggest an identical conclusion. Indisputably, the order established by the Arabs in the century following the Hijra was something novel. But originality alone does not tell the whole story. Prototype of every subsequent Islamic empire that it certainly was, the caliphate founded in the 7th century was also something very much more. The last, the climactic, and the most enduring empire of antiquity. Such is the claim that this book aims to prove. Yet it is as well to admit at the outset that such a task is far from easy. Certainty on a whole range of issues is impossible. There can only ever be speculation. Cosmologists speak of singularities, warpings of time and space where the laws of physics do not apply. The puzzle of Islam's origins might be viewed in a similar way, as a black hole sucking in a great spiraling swirl of influences before casting them back out in a radically different form. The career of Muhammad, traditionally cast as the pivotal episode in the entire history of the Middle East, serves both as the climax of my narrative of the collapse of Roman and Persian power, and as the point where that narrative fragments and breaks down. Does the Quran really date from the Prophet's lifetime? Where, if not in Mecca, might he have lived? Why are the references to him in the early caliphate so sparse, so enigmatic, and so late? The answers I have given to these questions are all of them unashamedly provisional, as I believe they have no choice but to be. That said, my ambition has been to sift and weigh the awesomely complex sources, to try and take account of all the many gaps and inconsistencies that exist within them, and then, albeit tentatively, to marshal them into something resembling a narrative. The context for this attempt, however, is not the traditional one, derived from the works of Muslims who lived whole centuries after Muhammad's death, but rather from those who inhabited the world into which he was born, the empire-shadowed, god-haunted world of late antiquity. Of the full dazzling colour, variety, and complexity of this age, the chronicles written by Muslim historians give barely a hint. Infidels, when they appear at all, are made to speak and act precisely as though they were Arabs. Roman emperors are transformed into mirror images of caliphs. Jewish scholars and Christian saints become straw men, shadowy and faceless. Fortunately, though, our understanding of the extraordinary melting pot of imperial and religious traditions that provided the context for Islam's evolution does not depend solely on Muslim chronicles. Far from it. While 7th century sources are threadbare to the point of non-existent, those from the preceding 2 centuries offer sumptuous riches. We have, for the last time, narratives composed by writers who self-consciously regarded themselves as the heirs of the great historians of classical Greece. We have collections of letters and digests of laws and compilations of speeches. We have a gazetteer written by a merchant and a work of anthropology written by a barbarian and a seeming infinitude of works of Christian piety, from histories of the church to lives of fabulously self-mortifying saints. In fact, by the standards of other periods of ancient history, we have an almost miraculous volume of evidence, something that historians of antiquity, like magpies flocking above a cache of diamonds, have seized upon with glee. As a result, over the past few decades, the study of the period has been revolutionized. A civilization previously dismissed as exhausted, sterile, and decaying has been comprehensively rehabilitated. What scholars emphasize now is less its decrepitude, more its energy, its exuberance, its inventiveness. We see in late antiquity, as one of its foremost historians has put it, a mass of experimentation, new ways being tried and new adjustments made. What emerges in the century or so after Muhammad as the religion called Islam is one consequence of this mass of experimentation. But there are a whole multitude of others, too. The most significant of all these, of course, are Judaism and Christianity, faiths that by the time of Muhammad had taken on something like the form they wear today, but that had once themselves been swirls of beliefs and doctrines no less unformed than those professed by the Arabs in the first century of their empire. The story of how Islam came to define itself and to invent its own past is only part of a much broader story, one that is ultimately about how Jews, Christians, and Muslims all came by their understanding of religion. No other revolution in human thought, perhaps, has done more to transform the world. No other revolution, then, it might be argued, demands more urgently to be put in proper context. That is why a history of Islam's origins cannot be written without reference to the origins of Judaism and Christianity, and why, in turn, a history of the origins of Judaism and Christianity cannot be written without reference to the world that incubated them both. The vision of God, to which both rabbis and bishops subscribed, and which Muhammad's followers inherited, did not emerge out of nowhere. The monotheisms that would end up established as state religions from the Atlantic to Central Asia had ancient and possibly unexpected roots. To trace them is to cast a searchlight across the entire civilization of late antiquity, from the dental hygiene of Zoroastrian priests to the frontier policy of Roman strategists, from fantasies about Alexander the Great in Syria to tales of buried books of spells in Iraq, from Jews who thought Christ the Messiah to Christians who lived like Jews. All are pieces in the jigsaw. It would certainly make little sense to trace the course of the revolution that would climax with the forging of the caliphate by starting with the revelations of the Muslim prophet. Accordingly, we begin not in Mecca, nor even in Jerusalem, but in a land that was the wellspring for two incalculably fruitful convictions, that a human empire might be global, and that the power of an all-good God might be universal. We begin in Persia. Part 2. Jahiliya. Religion taught by a prophet or by a preacher of the truth is the only foundation on which to build a great and powerful empire. Ibn Khaldun, A Universal History. Chapter 2. Iran Shah. Shah Thing. Any Persian king who doubted that he ruled the most favoured of peoples had only to stroke his chin. Whereas the creator of the universe, in his ineffable wisdom, had seen fit to give the inhabitants of more benighted regions hair that was either too curly or too straight, he had granted the men of Persia beards that embodied the happy medium. Here, in the magnificence of their personal grooming, the Persians found evidence of a far more profound preeminence. "Our land," they like to point out, "lies in the midst of other lands, and our people are the most noble and illustrious of beings." As with facial hair, then, so with the various attributes and qualities that made for greatness. The Persian people appeared to enjoy the best of all possible worlds. And certainly, in the centuries that had followed Christ, the name they had carved out for themselves had been a splendid one. Their dominion had spread far beyond the limits of Persia itself, from the frontiers of Syria in the west to those of the Hindu Kush in the east, from the deserts of Arabia in the south to the mountains of Armenia in the north. Nevertheless, the very wealth and glory of such an empire could on occasion lead to anxiety as well as pride. Just as flies were drawn to sumptuous banquets and locusts to fields of corn, so savages were to silk and gold. The Persians, whose reputation for courage and boldness and skill on the day of battle was well merited, had rarely deigned to regard such intruders as anything other than annoyances, to be swatted every so often with an almost disdainful ease. But that, over the course of the fourth Christian century, had begun to change. Rumours of war from distant frontiers had come to shadow the mood of the Persian heartlands. Victories were still being won, but against increasingly fearsome opponents. The waves crashing against the bulwarks of Persian power appeared to be growing more violent with every passing year. Whole tribes of people, whole nations, were on the move. Soon enough, and the news was darkening even further. Nomads were alarming enough, but not half so alarming as nomads with a taste for putting down roots. By the middle of the fifth Christian century, the empire of the Persians was standing eyeball to eyeball with a menacingly new order of foe, a kingdom of warrior horsemen who had parked themselves directly on its northeastern flank. Who were the Heftalites, and where did they come from? No one was entirely sure. When a people such as the Persians, long settled in a much cherished homeland, ventured to contemplate the drear immensity of the lands that stretched northwards of their empire, the origins of the savages who infested it, and of the winds that gusted through its grasses, were liable to appear to them mysteries, equally without an answer. One popular theory, it was true, held that the enigmatic newcomers were Huns, the most fearsome, as they were the ugliest of all the steppe-land tribesmen. Others, however, pointed out that the Hephthalites, despite their curiously elongated skulls, their sinister taste for mullets, and their contemptibly un-Persian beards, had countenances that were almost attractive. Their skin was not a sallow, Hunnic yellow, but like that of the Persians themselves, fetchingly pale. Some took to calling them white Huns, a suggestion of hybridity that emphasized precisely why the Persians found them so unsettling. These were savages who had dared to found their own monarchy, their own capital city, even their own body of laws. The Persians, who had long gloried in their own triumphant possession of those appurtenances of civilization, could not possibly ignore such presumption. Nomads, who forgot their place, needed to be reminded of it, and fast. Indeed, so urgent was the problem that the Persian monarchy decided it could no longer afford to do as it had traditionally done, and delegate the patrolling of the eastern frontier to its underlings. The peril had grown too great. The time had come for the king of Persia, the Shahanshah, the king of kings himself, to tame the Hephthalites. So it was, during the campaigning season of AD 484, that an immense army advanced across the Gurgan Plain, an unsettled frontier zone extending east from the southernmost tip of the Caspian Sea, and which had increasingly come to mark the limits of Persian power. Beyond a landscape patterned with the reassuring marks of civilization, fields, kilns, and canals, there lurked untenanted badlands. The realm of the wolves, men called them, fit reflection of their aura of menace. As the wooded ramparts of a great chain of mountains, the Alburs, gradually receded into the distance, there came to stretch ahead of the task force an unbroken immensity of wild barley and oats and corn, rippling, so it seemed, to the limits of the world, the beginning of the steppes. Featureless as this landscape was, and lacking in anything that the Persians would have recognized as civilization, it had repeatedly frustrated the ambitions of would-be conquerors. Yet on this occasion, to anyone watching the great host of men, horses, and elephants as they trampled down the grasses, the invaders' prospects must have appeared no less glittering than the heads of their ferociously heavy lances. A Persian army at full strength was a fearsome sight. "Everything so far as the eye can reach," as one awe-struck observer put it, "is filled with the shimmer of arms. Whole plains and hills are crowded out by mail-clad horsemen. And by banners as well, since if there was one thing that a Persian warrior really adored, it was a showy flag. Every unit of cavalry possessed one. Great heavy drapes slung from crossbars, and emblazoned with flamboyant heraldic devices, stars, lions, boars. Most splendid of all, it went without saying, was the royal banner. Immeasurably the largest, it was also the most sumptuously adorned. Seeing it flapping massively in the breeze, the sunlight glinting off its embroidered gold, silver, and jewels, no one could have doubted who was leading the expedition into the realm of the Hephthalites. The King of Kings, like all his royal ancestors, possessed a literally supernatural mystique. Every Persian knew it, and what was owed to it, not merely their empire, but their very freedom. 2.5 centuries previously, when their forefathers had been slaves of foreign masters, the banner of their independence had been raised by a nobleman named Ardashir, a mighty hero possessed of a mandate from the heavens. No one in the whole of Persia had been more favoured of the gods. One of Ardashir's ancestors, a man named Sasan, had officiated as the high priest of the country's holiest and most venerable temple at Istakhar. Here, ever since ancient times, it had been the custom to present the severed heads of vanquished enemies to the great warrior goddess, Anahita, the strong and immaculate. Ardashir himself had proved a worthy lieutenant of this ferocious divinity. By AD 224, he had liberated Persia from the rule of outsiders, and to such crushing effect that he had established the Persians themselves as the masters of a host of subject peoples. It was scarcely surprising, then, in the light of such a colossal achievement, that his countrymen should have distinguished about his person the eerie flickering of an aura more than human. His fa, the Persians termed it, the mark of his divine election. Here, no less than the empire he had founded, had been a precious heirloom. Unceasingly, as the years went by and generations sprung from the family of Sasan succeeded generation to the throne of Persia, so had a fa continued to shadow each new king. Sometimes it was glimpsed in the shape of a ram, sometimes as a golden ray of light, sometimes in human form, like the sudden flitting of a figure that was no reflection across a mirror. The glamour of it all, naturally enough, helped contribute to a fearsome reputation. Even the Sasanians' enemies, people with every reason to loathe their pretensions, found it difficult not to cringe before them. "A monarchy that is proud and exceedingly powerful," so one foreign commentator described the dynasty in a tone of rueful awe. "For it is old and most intimidating indeed to those who inhabit the world." Peroz, the king who had led the massive army into the Gurgan Plain, was, like all his predecessors, a descendant of Sasan. Indeed, in many ways, he was the epitome of a Sasanian, tall and handsome, in the imposing manner expected by the Persians of their royalty, and with an exceptional talent, even by the standards of his forefathers, for playing the dandy. Just as the great banner that billowed above his tent glimmered with fabulous adornments, so did the king himself. For it was his habit to sport, in addition to all his other sumptuous jewellery, a pearl of wonderful whiteness, greatly prized on account of its extraordinary size, as a stud in his ear. Foreigners may well have viewed such obsession with personal adornment as effeminate, but the Persians themselves knew better. A haughty and refined delicacy of manner, a sashaying, hip-swaying gait, a reluctance so much as to be seen in public stepping to one side in response to a call of nature, these were the marks in Persia of a bold and gallant warrior. Anyone who had the wherewithal was fully expected to pose and strut like a peacock. Rare was the Persian who knowingly underdressed. The gorgeous showiness of their fashion was notorious. "Most of them," it was reported of the Persian upper classes, "are so resplendent in clothes gleaming with many shimmering colours, that although they leave their robes open in front and on the sides, and let them flutter in the wind, yet from their head to their shoes no part of the body is seen uncovered." Yet Peroz himself, for all his manifest talent at cutting a dash, was not defined by his sense of fashion alone. Just as significant in the eyes of his subjects was his palpable concern for their welfare. Vain he might have been, but he was also, in the noblest tradition of his forebears, determined to battle chaos, uphold order, and propagate justice. Which was just as well, for troubles, and the efforts of Peroz to resolve them, had been a feature of his 25-year reign since day one. It had begun with a drought. Even as Peroz was being crowned, his people had been famine-stalked. The young king had responded with energy, boldness, and vision. He had slashed taxes, lavished state subsidies on the poor, pressured the nobility into sharing their stockpiles of food with the hungry and desperate masses. Centuries later, this reform program was still being commemorated in admiring tones. "Only one man died of hunger in the entire empire." Witness, even if not literally true, to a model of famine relief. Next, looking to the northeast frontier, Peroz had shown himself similarly determined to fight the growing menace of the Heftalites. More than any Sasanian before him, he had committed himself and all the resources of his empire to the great game that was the interplay of tribal rivalries in Central Asia. Merv, an ancient city midway between the Hindu Kush and the Caspian Sea, and with the potential to dominate Persia's northeastern marches, had been transformed into a mighty bastion of royal power. Massive ramparts, crowned by fired brick towers and scored with arrow slits, were built around a vast circular citadel. Meanwhile, other strongholds, strategically situated along the frontier itself, had been founded from scratch. Treasure had been lavished on fortifications, garrisons, and supply depots. Snaking across the fields of the Gurgan Plain, for instance, fashioned out of red brick and extending over some 150 miles, was an immense wall, the single greatest barrier ever constructed in the Near East. By the time Peroz, with a quarter century of such efforts behind him, ventured out into the steppes through the gates of the red brick wall, it was as a general with a most formidable reputation, as a daring and warlike man. Simultaneously, however, there was a darker side to Peroz's record. Our kings, so the Persians like to boast, have never been accused of treachery. And yet this was, perhaps, to gild the lily just a bit. Even in his dealings with the White Huns, Peroz had been known to indulge in the occasional bout of collaboration. Born a younger son, he had only been able to seize the throne in the first place with Heftalite backing. More damaging to his good name, however, had been the disastrous consequence of an earlier expedition he had led into the realm of the White Huns, eastwards of the steppelands, to the region known as Bactria, where he had found himself being ambushed in a wooded valley, surrounded and forced to sue for terms. Predictably enough, these had proved debilitating and humiliating in equal measure. A number of key Persian strongholds had been surrendered, a crippling ransom imposed, and the Shahanshah himself, that god among men, obliged to prostrate himself before the boots of the Heftalite Khan. Returning to the fray for a second time, then, Peroz was undoubtedly motivated as much by personal revenge as he was by the grander demands of geopolitics. Injured dignity required him to travel to war amid all the magnificence appropriate to the King of Kings. A teeming retinue of chefs, cooks, domestics, makeup artists and wardrobe assistants, treasury officials with chests of silver coins, even a princess or two, all had been brought to accompany their master into the anonymous immensity of the steppes. It was not only by force of arms that Peroz sought to tame the savage Heftalites. He aimed to dazzle them as well. Nor were the Heftalites his only targets. Peroz faced a challenge south of the steppeland frontier as well as north of it. The lords who ruled there, in the great swathe of territory that stretched between Persia and the Heftalite kingdom, could lay claim to a heritage that was scarcely less glorious than that of the Shahanshah himself. Prior to the revolt of Ardashir, it was their ancestors who had ruled the empire that now ranked as Sasanian. Parthians, they called themselves, and they still cherished memories of their golden age, when the Persians and a whole host of other peoples had been kept satisfyingly under their thumb. Not that the power of the greatest Parthian families had ever truly been broken. Although, in the wake of Ardashir's famous victory of AD 224 over the Parthian king, members of the royal family had been variously exterminated or driven into exile, the warrior barons had easily weathered the change of regime. The seven great lords of Parthia acknowledged no superiors, save for the Sasanians themselves. The foundations of their dominance had been cemented into place over the course of many centuries by ancient law. Impressively, the mightiest Parthian dynasty, the Karin, could trace a history of heroic prowess back to the very beginnings of time, when one of their forefathers had toppled a demon king, no less, Dahag, a necromancer so evil that two venomous serpents had sprouted from his shoulders and promptly started munching on the brains of babies, had ruled the world for an entire millennium, until the ancestor of the Kareen, a blacksmith by the name of Carver, had led a revolt against the tyrant. Such a pedigree was a fitting measure of the pretensions of the Parthian lords, pretensions that had the backing of prodigious wealth and manpower. Indeed, it was the measure of these that the Sasanian kings, focusing their energies and attentions upon the western half of their empire, had traditionally been content to give the east a wide berth. No Shahanshah would ever admit it, of course, but across much of Parthia, Sasanian royal authority was largely a matter of smoke and mirrors. The Kareen and their fellow dynasts governed their fiefdoms less as subjects of the Persian monarchy than as partners in a sometimes uneasy confederacy. "For you are the lords, each of your own province," as one of them had once declared ringingly to his fellows, "and the possessors of very great power." Persian the empire may have been, but it remained in its eastern provinces a Parthian one as well. And here, for a Shahanshah with little choice but to devote his energies to combating the Hephthalites, was a most awkward complication. The urgent need to strengthen imperial defences along the northeast frontier, whether by buttressing existing cities or by raising new ones, hardly sat well with the time-honoured policy of not treading on Parthian toes. For all his swagger, Peroz was highly sensitive to this problem. While Hephthalite support had been useful in helping him claim the throne, the decisive blow had actually been struck by a Parthian warlord, Raham, of the family of Mihran. It was he who had defeated, captured, and executed Peroz's elder brother, and then crowned Peroz as his protégé. 25 years on, the Persian king's ambition still rested on the support of the Parthian dynasts. Without it, he had no chance of defeating the upstart Hephthalite kingdom. Simultaneously, however, there could be no prospect of ultimate victory without marching his armies and labour gangs directly across Parthian land. A most awkward circle to square. But not perhaps wholly impossible. Peroz was subtle as well as bold, and he knew that the pen might, on occasion, be wielded alongside the sword. Even while summoning his warriors and engineers to the defence of his empire, he had also been busy mustering his minstrels, his bards, and his scribes. Conscious that the days when it had been sufficient for the House of Sasan to trumpet an exclusively Persian descent were gone, Peroz had settled upon a simple but audacious expedient. He had ordered its past rewritten. A new family tree, one more acceptable to Parthian sensibilities, more inclusive, more multicultural, was now required. So it was, obedient to their master's requirements, that scholars in the royal service had set themselves to a comprehensive upgrading of the Sasanian lineage. Fortunately, preserved in ancient texts and in the memories of priests and poets, the perfect ancestors had been waiting shimmeringly at hand. The Kaenids, like Carver, the blacksmith from whom the Kareen claimed descent, were heroes from the fabulously distant past, with biographies that featured talking birds, flying chariots, fortresses raised by demons, and other fantastical wonders. Unlike Carver, a mere blacksmith, however, they had all of them been graced with the Far, since so impeccably royal had been their dynasty that even its very name derived from the antique title of Kai, or King. This, however, was not the main reason why Peroz was suddenly so keen to claim descent from them. Rather, the true appeal of the Kaenids lay in the location of their realm, which had lain, not in Persia, but in Parthia and northwards into Gurgan. It was here that the Kaenid kings, the tireless guardians of their people, had made heroic stand after heroic stand, fighting in defence both of their kingdom and of their Far, resolute against savage enemies whose fiendish ambition it had been to filch both. As Peroz advanced northwards from Parthia against the Hephthalites, he made sure to do as the self-proclaimed heir of the Caenids, as a king whose ultimate roots lay in the selfsame lands he had come to defend. Eran, these had anciently been called, the realm of the Arians, or Iran. The Persians, who traced their own origins back to this primordial northeastern kingdom, and therefore regarded themselves as being not a whit less Arian than the Parthians, had always been keen on the name. Long before the time of Peroz, the House of Sasan had been making great play with it in their inscriptions, their titles, and all their endless bragging. They had even termed their own empire Iran-Shar, the Dominion of the Arians. Now, though, under Peroz, the manufacturing of links between the Sasanian monarchy and the fabled Caenid homeland had become an obsession. As the king gazed into a perilous and uncertain future, so had he sought to influence it by sponsoring an official systemization of the past. Blatant fabrications had enabled Ardashir to be enshrined once and for all as what Peroz so desperately needed him to be, a descendant of the Caenids. Meanwhile, in order to buttress the plausibility of this fraud, centuries of history were simply erased. The end result was a lineage that perfectly served the desperate needs of the time. No less than a stockpile of weapons on the great northeastern trunk road, or a raw new fortress on the red wall beyond the Al-Burs Mountains, it spoke of both a crisis and an implacable determination to resolve it. Battle-hardened pragmatist and self-appointed heir to ancient kings who had fought demons, the Shahanshah rode to war as both. That Peroz had resurrected the antique title of Kai, that he had named his eldest son Carvad, after the first of the Caenids, that he had stamped his coins with any number of allusions to the legendary dynasty, here were no mere idle self-indulgences. Rather, they served as potent markers of his utter seriousness of purpose. He had a dual strategy. To win the hearts and minds of his Parthian subjects, even as he met the Heftalites with an iron fist. And it seemed to be working. The decisive adventure had been launched. Peroz and his army had passed through the gates of the Great Red Wall and headed out onto the steppes. Advancing on the nearest Heftalite stronghold, just beyond the frontier, they had found it abandoned. Clearly the terror of the royal name had rendered the savages too terrified to stand and fight. Peroz ordered the settlement razed to the ground. Meanwhile, behind him, in Parthia, everything appeared calm. Now all that was needed was to track down the enemy, corner them, and wipe them from the face of the earth. Then the Shahanshah received the news he had been yearning to hear. The Heftalites were ahead of him. Their outriders had been spotted, and their main army was drawing near. Peroz issued brisk orders, summoning the champions of Iran-Shah to battle. At once the stir of preparation spread across the camp. Archers oiled and tested their bows, drivers heaved war towers onto the backs of their elephants, and foot soldiers dusted down their wicker shields. Most urgent of all, however, was the need to ready the expedition's ultimate killers. The deadliest strike force in the world, a one-piece helmet, skillfully crafted to look exactly like a man's face, iron plates, greaves and gloves, whips and maces slung from the belt, a lance so long and heavy that it could be handled only if first secured to the side of a mount. These were the tools of an armoured horseman in the service of the Shahanshah. Barely human such a warrior might appear when fully furnished. A moving image wrought by a hammer. Lifted up into their saddles on the shoulders of attendants, urging forward steeds that were themselves sheathed in mail and plate, forming themselves into a glittering line in the front rank of the army, the heavy cavalry of Iran-Shah could know themselves worthy heirs of their ancestors, heroes of steel, just as the Caenids had been. And glancing behind them at the slight rise where their king had stationed himself, as every Shahanshah did prior to a battle, they saw the ultimate reassurance of this. Now, more than ever, Peroz aimed to pose as a figure of epic. Great care had been taken to ensure that his horse was the tallest and most handsome around, Attendants stood poised by the royal mount to ensure that it would not whinny, nor urinate, nor in any other way lower the heroic tone. The king himself, as ever, was positively ablaze with sumptuous jewellery. Meanwhile, planted behind him, where it could be seen by everyone in the ranks, there fluttered his massive standard, the Derefsh Kaviani, or flag of Carver. An expression of Sasanian power, it was also authentically and heroically pan-Iranian. It was no coincidence, for instance, that its name bore witness to the fabled ancestor of the Karin. For once, prior to its adornment with jewels and tassels, it had been a humble leather apron, worn, so it was said, by the demon-slaying blacksmith himself. Now, as Peroz gave the order for his cavalry to advance, it was his aim to emulate the feat of Carver, for he was looking to rout a whole army of demons. Lumbering forwards, trotting at first, then breaking into a thunderous gallop, the heavily armoured cavalrymen aimed their lances at the more lightly armed Hephthalites. Through the dust clouds kicked up by their horses, it appeared that the enemy was clumping together in a disorganised panic. Then the Hephthalites broke, turned and streamed back across the dead centre of the plain. Raising a cry of triumph, the Persian cavalry immediately fanned out, aiming to encircle their retreating foes. They charged ever faster, the dust rose ever thicker, arrows hissing down through the clouds of grits began to rattle and bounce off their armour. But the men of Iran Shah disdained so much as to flinch. From head to foot their iron cladding was proof against any missiles and a sure defence against all wounds. The arrows of contemptible nomads could do them no harm. They were, to all intents and purposes, invulnerable. Victory surely was theirs. Then, suddenly, they felt their horses' hooves give way and begin to paw the air. The riders themselves flew forwards and found themselves dropping through a nightmarish haze of dust and arrows into the bowels of a massive ditch. Too late, the front ranks of the Persian cavalry realized that the Hephthalites had prepared for their attack with fiendish cunning. They had excavated a great trench, dug across most of the plain, which they had then covered with a thin layer of reeds and earth. They had left only the center intact to facilitate their own retreat. Meanwhile, the pursuing Persians had blundered directly into the death trap. And such was the spirit of fury with which they had launched their pursuit of the enemy, that those to the rear of the vanguard failed to notice the catastrophe which had overwhelmed those in the front rank. And so, with horse and lance, they continued to ride into the trench, and to trample down their own fellows, so that all were destroyed. And among the dead was Peroz himself. As to how precisely the Shahanshah had met his end, various accounts were given. Some said that as he crashed into the Hephthalite trench, he had torn off his own ear and kept it clenched in his palm, for he had not wanted some savage nomad to lay claim to his famous pearl. Others said that he was left trapped in a cleft in the ground, where he died of hunger, and others yet that he had crawled away from the killing field, only to be devoured by wild animals. Two things were certain, though. First, neither Peroz's body nor his great pearl was ever found. Second, his far had abandoned him for good. Firestarter. Only a few weary and grime-streaked Persian survivors managed to stumble back from the killing fields of Gurgan. The news that they brought with them could hardly have had more menacing implications. The gore that had filled the Hephthalite trenches might as well have been the lifeblood of Iran Shah itself. No realm in the world could endure for long without treasure or men, and the slaughter had left the Sasanian Empire drained of both. Only a massive effort on the part of the imperial tax collectors had enabled the expedition to ride out in the first place. Now, with the flower of the Empire's cavalry destroyed, there was nothing left to blunt the scythings of the Hephthalites' own horsemen. The frontier stood wide open. All the bulwarks that Peroz had laboured so hard to construct lay abandoned and tenantless. Whisperings of terror thickening into ever more certain rumour, was soon darkening the eastern dominions of Iran Shah. Of whole regions where once the Kayanids had ruled, turned by the Heftalites to shambles of blood and ash. Here, in the picking to the bone of the ancient heartlands of the Aryan people, was a fearsome challenge to the practical functioning of the entire Sasanian realm. Both its prestige and its tax base were under mortal threat. But this was not the worst. The Heftalite flames were scorching more than fields and cities. The conflagration was also consuming structures regarded by those who had raised them as sources of truly awesome holiness. Just as fire in the hands of the wicked might be used to destroy, so also in the hands of the virtuous might it be consecrated to the service of the heavens. This was why, studded across Iran Shah, there were temples that contained no statues, but rather, in each one, an altar in the middle of an enclosure holding a large quantity of ashes, where priests kept a fire eternally burning. Desecrate such an altar, so it was believed, and the order of the cosmos itself would start to totter. In the aftermath of Peroz's overpowering and crushing defeat, as fire temples across the northern reaches of Parthia were sent crashing into ruin by the Heftalites, there were many in Iran Shah who saw in the annihilation of the royal army something far more troubling and portentous than a mere military debacle, a darkening of the universe itself. Yet hope remained. The three holiest fire temples, the most luminescent and charged with power, remained inviolate. One, the fire of the stallion, was enclosed within rings of towering fortifications on the summit of a hill in Media, the mountainous region that lay to the north of Persia. The second, the fire of the Far, stood secure within Persia itself. Only the third, the Adur Burzen Mir, fire of Mir is great, seemed a potential risk from the Heftalites, for it lay close to the front line in Parthia on the ancient highway that led directly to the steppe lands of the north. To the devout of Iran Shah, however, the notion that one of their three most sacred fire temples might be despoiled, its ashes scattered, its flame extinguished, appeared almost sacrilegious in itself. To imagine such a thing was to contemplate a cosmos terminally sick. No mortal hand had brought the three great fires into being. Rather, the good God, Ormazd, the Eternal, the All-Radiant, the Supremely Wise, had lit them, like three lights for the watching of the world. And the world had urgently needed watching. Ormazd, the fountainhead of all that was good and pure and right, was not the only creator god. Truly, ran an ancient verse, there are two primal spirits, twins, renowned for being in conflict. In thought and word and deed they are two, the best and the worst. While Ormazd had brought Asha, truth and order to the universe, his shadow, Ahriman, snake-haired and darkness-vomiting, had spawned their opposite, Droog, the lie. The cohorts of evil were everywhere. They ranged from nomads, such as the Heftalites, to that most fiendish and wicked of all Ahriman's creations, the frog. In the ongoing struggle against such adversaries, mortals choosing the path of righteousness and light had long cherished the assistance that Ormazd had sent them. Back in primordial times, the great fires had swept across the face of the earth, going wherever they were needed. One had helped in the overthrow of Dahag, the serpent-shouldered necromancer. Another had assisted a Kayanid king in a particularly arduous bout of idol-smashing. Stationary though the fires had since become, they had lost not a spark of their heavenly potency. They remained what they had always been, the surest guardians of the proper ordering of the world. Humanity, too, however, had a part to play. Mortal men and women everywhere needed to commit themselves to the cause of light, to live in such a way as to render themselves branches of living flame. Fortunately, they were not without guidance.